Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Autumn Ghost, How the Battle Against a Polio Epidemic Revolutionized Modern Medical Care, by Hannah Wunsch. Narrated by Emily Durante. Introduction. In 2020, COVID-19 catapulted intensive care into the public's consciousness across the world. The complex life-saving support provided in these units became headline news. But until quite recently in medical history, there was no intensive care. 70 years ago, anyone who struggled to breathe, whose heart gave out, or whose kidneys shut down would be kept comfortable and left to die. There were no ventilators, no monitors keeping track of vital signs minute to minute, no expertise of nurses and physicians to keep critically ill patients alive, and no dedicated units in hospitals for the care of such patients. Eugene Brunwald, a cardiologist, wrote about his experience of caring for patients in 1952. "We admitted patients with heart attacks wherever a bed was available on the medical service, but always as far from the nurse's station as possible so that they would not be disturbed by the commotion, especially the frequent telephone ringing. It was not uncommon for me, when arriving on the medical floor at 6 a.m. to draw blood to be sent for testing, to discover that one of my patients had died quietly during the night. Older physicians accepted this as just the way it was." This is the story of how we got from 1952 to now. In particular, it is the story of one disease that was nearly forgotten: polio. First came the dreaded virus, causing epidemics in the early 20th century and leaving paralysis in its wake. Then came the miracle of a vaccine. But before the vaccine and the near eradication of the virus, polio had a wider impact on the medical world, driving innovation in both hospital and rehabilitation care. This is a story of the citizens of one city, Copenhagen, from their resistance to occupation during a real war in the early 1940s to their extraordinary fight to save lives during a war against polio in the summer and fall of 1952. It is a tale of two doctors, one a consummate insider, Henry Kai Alexander Lassen, and one a complete outsider, Bjorn Oe Ibsen, as well as a story of over 1,000 medical and dental students who set aside their own lives to help patients breathe. It is a story of those patients who died from polio and others who lived to share their experiences and fight for rehabilitation and disability rights. Finally, it is the story of how a convergence of courage, coincidences, experience, and knowledge from disparate medical fields helped transform routine medical care for millions and propelled the world into the era of modern intensive care. A few notes on references and terminology. Any descriptions or details that are included come from sources such as photographs, interviews, or publications. References for all quotations and many other statements are provided in the notes at the end of the book. I've made it clear in the text the few times I have chosen to speculate. I have also simplified some of the Danish naming for English-speaking audiences. All quotations used in the text from Danish-language source material were translated by native Danish speakers. Poetry by Rosa Abrahamsen was translated by Michael Favala Goldman. The book also includes some words, particularly related to disability, that may be considered outdated or offensive to modern audiences. I have chosen to include these words and place them in the context of the time rather than exclude quotations because of their use. Different countries and cultures may have distinct preferences for how to describe people with disabilities. I have tried to use terminology that is respectful to all, and I hope listeners will forgive any choices that are not their preferred phrasing. August 1952. Copenhagen. Vivi Ebert was just 12 years old. She was going to die. Near the end of August, Vivi came home from school saying she had a headache and went to bed. The next day, she complained that she couldn't move her arms and legs well. On Tuesday, August 26th, she had a fever, headache, stiff neck, and some paralysis, the telltale signs of polio. Her mother called an ambulance, and Vivi was brought to the hospital. She already had weakness in one arm, but much more concerning, she also had difficulty breathing. Since early July, the hospital had admitted many patients just like Vivi, and almost all of them had died. As her symptoms worsened, the doctors and nurses knew she likely had only a few more hours, or days at most, to live. The polio epidemic that year in Copenhagen had begun with a trickle of cases in July. By the end of the summer, the disease was roaring through Denmark's capital and outlying regions. It was far worse than in previous years, with more cases of paralysis and difficulty breathing than anyone had ever seen. There were daily news bulletins on the radio announcing the latest areas with outbreaks. Ambulances kept pulling up at the hospital hour after hour, day after day. By late August, there were 50 admissions a day, all with severe polio. The doctors and nurses would have focused on one key question: could the patient take a breath? For someone who was struggling to breathe, there was little that could be done except to try to keep them comfortable. Henrik Hai Alexander Lassen, the chief of the Blydam, the only infectious disease hospital in the city, was a physician and an expert on polio. He had cared for hundreds of patients with the illness. But this strain of the virus seemed to be causing more cases than usual and was viciously deadly. By the time Vivi showed up, he and his team had already lost dozens of patients, many of them infants and children. Vivi was about to be next. The previous decades had been full of major medical advances. Antibiotics allowed for treatment of bacterial infections. The discovery of insulin meant that a diagnosis of diabetes was no longer a death sentence, and X-rays provided a way to see inside the body. New vaccines had even been developed for infectious diseases such as diphtheria and influenza. But in 1952, there was still little anyone could offer as treatment for patients with polio, and there was also no vaccine for prevention. Modern medicine was failing, and polio was winning. That was about to change. Part 1. The Spectre Rises. 1. Don't eat the apples. Standing tall above the entrance of the Blydam Hospital, Pallas Athena, the Greek goddess of wisdom and war, looked out over Copenhagen. Since 1879, she had stood guard, with spear and shield in hand, helmet on her head, and flowing gown clinging to her body. Flanked by three children she protected from the arrows of the plague god, Athena gazed to the left, down the tree-lined Blydam Road, watching as the sick made their way to the entrance, by ambulance, in taxis and cars, and on foot, turning into the stone drive that led to the hospital entrance. All those in need were admitted, welcomed by a doorman in pressed dark trousers, white jacket, and cap. They were ushered through an elaborate carved entryway to be assessed by the doctors and nurses. But not all who entered came out again. In 1853, an outbreak of cholera in Copenhagen had killed about 2,000 people. Many residents of the city fled, camping out in tents in the open air of the countryside. The Lord Mayor and City Council determined to improve sanitation, water supplies, and housing, and also to provide better care for the sick. By 1863, the municipal hospital had opened, but it was quickly overcrowded. The authorities decided that two additional hospitals were needed, a large one to care specifically for those with infectious diseases, a fever hospital, and a smaller quarantine hospital near the harbor, where the ships came in carrying individuals who might be infected with myriad diseases. The fever hospital, the Blydam, was commissioned as the first true epidemic hospital in Denmark, to be situated on the outskirts of the city, distanced from any residential neighborhood. It was named for the ponds nearby, the word bly, meaning pail, and dam, meaning pond. The name was purported to refer to the whitening of canvas done by bleaching men, who would lay out the fabric in long rows on the shore to be bleached by the sun, then printed with colored patterns and turned into curtains and pillowcases. The Øresund Hospital, used for quarantine, was completed in 1876. The Bly Dam, opening 3 years later, was built like an army barracks, with multiple low buildings of one or two stories to allow adequate air circulation and to provide isolation for patients with virulent infections. The grounds were leafy, with gardens, trees, and attractive pathways winding between buildings. Initially, the hospital had the capacity to care for 312 patients, with another 100 in tents as needed. After its opening on April 1, 1879, the hospital saw a steady stream of patients with scarlet fever, diphtheria, measles, and croup, as well as a smattering of the more uncommon infections, such as smallpox, cholera, and typhus. In the first 50 years, there were 48,542 patients with diphtheria and 44,354 with scarlet fever. Patients were isolated and provided with general nursing. They were cared for rather than treated, as there were no antibiotics or effective medications. As demand grew, the hospital expanded, adding new buildings to care for the endless stream of infected individuals. By 1921, the Bly Dam could accommodate 499 patients, including 72 in isolation rooms. In 1939, an ear, nose, and throat, ENT, department was added. In 1946, after the introduction of penicillin led to a substantial decrease in cases of diphtheria and scarlet fever, four of the buildings were no longer needed and were converted to a new general medicine ward. Modern medicine was beginning to provide the tools to conquer infectious diseases. In those early years, the doctors and nurses in the Bly Dam rarely saw poliomyelitis. Polio, as it is commonly known, is caused by a virus. While in many the illness is mild, in an unlucky minority, polio attacks nerves in the spinal column and the brainstem, resulting in paralysis of limbs, difficulty breathing, and sometimes death. The virus has probably been around since antiquity, but the only references in early texts are vague, descriptions of lameness and withered limbs. An ancient Egyptian stone slab held at the Glyptotek, a museum in Copenhagen, depicts a priest with a shortened and thinned left leg, with his foot showing the traditional droop typical of flaccid paralysis from polio. However, the cause of this deformity remains speculative. John Paul, in his comprehensive book on the history of poliomyelitis, notes that Hippocrates, who described several infectious diseases in ancient Greece, does not describe polio. The disease is thought to have been endemic, meaning that it was widely present. But because it seemed to cause little paralysis, it generally went unnoticed. By the 18th century, descriptions that more clearly matched those of paralytic polio began to surface. In a prelude to the hundreds of thousands of similar stories to come, Sir Walter Scott, the great writer born in 1771 in Edinburgh, described his own experience at 18 months of age with what was most likely a case of polio. "I was discovered to be affected with the fever. It held me 3 days. On the fourth, when they went to bathe me as usual, they discovered that I had lost the power of my right leg." Sporadic cases with paralysis were recognized in the 1800s, and polio gradually came to be viewed as a disease separate from other well-known maladies of childhood, such as scarlet fever and the bloody flux, dysentery. There were no epidemics, but polio was lying in wait, biding its time. The outbreak that ultimately caught the world's attention cropped up around Stockholm in 1887. Carl Oscar Medin, an experienced and well-respected pediatrician in Sweden, had seen occasional cases over the previous decade. But when an epidemic of paralytic polio involving 44 children occurred in the Stockholm region, Medin investigated cases as they occurred, with an attention to clinical observation and follow-up of the individual patients. In August 1890, he presented his findings in detail to a large audience at the 10th International Medical Congress in Berlin. It was the first clear description of this epidemic disease from, as Paul described him, a thoroughly reliable, articulate, and experienced pediatrician. Many people had the disease with no symptoms at all. For those who did show symptoms, they usually included fever, fatigue, vomiting, diarrhea, and headache for a few days. For most, these minor symptoms resolved without any other manifestation of the disease. As the 20th century neared, a small percentage of cases progressed to paralysis, sometimes immediately and sometimes after the initial symptoms had cleared. In 1917, this sequence of two humps, minor symptoms, then an initial reprieve, followed by the onset of paralysis, was inaccurately dubbed the dromedary form of polio. What remained a complete mystery during these investigations was how people contracted polio. The concept of contagion, which was by then well established for diseases such as smallpox, did not seem to be considered. After 1887, paralytic polio cases remained sporadic. The first big outbreak documented in the U.S. was in Rutland County, Vermont, in 1894. The local general practitioner, Charles Solomon Caverly, also the president of the Vermont State Board of Health since 1891, took careful observations and followed up with each patient, reporting on 132 cases, including 18 deaths. His detailed description of the epidemic of 1894 was recognized as a key contribution to understanding this previously unnoticed disease. Vermont was a harbinger of things to come. So many people in the state had developed paralytic polio that Caverly and a colleague, Robert W. Lovett, an orthopedic surgeon, set up clinics and then hospitals to provide care for those who were left with physical disabilities. The need for such facilities would spread across states and countries over the next 50 years. Caverly died in 1918 from another disease that swept the globe, influenza. By the start of the 20th century, this new epidemic nature of polio, with clustered cases of paralysis, was recognized by the medical establishment. Medin's assistant, Ivar Wickman, added an important additional piece to the puzzle. Polio was contagious. Equally important, he recognized that many people with mild symptoms that may have been mistaken for other ailments, or even those who were asymptomatic, could in fact have polio, and these individuals could transmit the disease. Until then, doctors and public health officials had focused on counting only those who experienced paralysis. For parents, paralysis was all that really mattered. A mild fever or headache passed, like many other childhood illnesses. But from the perspective of epidemiology, counting those milder cases to understand the extent of the disease and who was at risk was essential. By including those cases with only minor symptoms, Wickman could trace outbreaks that started with transmission in schools and demonstrate how the virus then traveled into homes, and from there on to other towns and cities, infecting individuals along the way. In 1916, polio hit the U.S. with an epidemic larger than had ever been seen. The first wave started in May and early June, with an official announcement in a press bulletin on June 17th of a polio epidemic in Brooklyn, New York. The city's mayor declared New York in a state of great and imminent peril, and expanded the emergency powers of the Department of Health. The U.S. Public Health Service sent in officials, epidemiologists, and infectious disease experts. By mid-August, there were 6,653 cases of polio in New York and thousands across other states. Public gatherings were restricted, with playgrounds and children's rooms and libraries closed, children banned from movie theaters, and streetcars and public telephones disinfected every night. Sunday schools were closed and circuses performed to audiences without children. While people understood by then that polio was somehow transmissible, the details of exactly how it spread remained out of reach. In 1908, Carl Landsteiner, a Viennese biologist who later won the Nobel Prize for his discovery of blood groups, along with his assistant, Erwin Popper, identified polio as a filterable virus, paradoxically meaning it evaded being strained out. The virus slipped through a Birkfeld candle, a filter made up of billions of skeletons of microscopic marine organisms that created channels so small that they trapped bacteria. Landsteiner and Popper conducted a simple experiment. First, they took spinal cord fluid from a person who had died of the disease. Next, they poured this fluid through the filter. When they injected this finely filtered fluid into monkeys, the monkeys developed polio. Landsteiner and Popper correctly deduced that there had to be some causative agent that was smaller than any bacterium. Even without being able to see it under a microscope, they knew the virus had to be there. Remarkably, the work carried out on viruses up through the early 1950s was done without ever being able to see the virus. Polio was an infectious agent that mostly remained theoretical, although the paralysis it caused was certainly real. Despite Landsteiner and Popper's work to identify the causal agent and Wickman's observations that showed people were contagious, exactly how the virus got from person to person was unclear. Was it through touch, animals, insects, the air? Many diseases were more common and more severe in deprived areas owing to a lack of sanitation and clean water. Cholera and typhoid fever, for example, occurred where sewage and drinking water mixed, with outbreaks most often in slums. Despite a recognition by public health experts that these diseases were successfully eradicated when the real danger was identified and removed, for instance, by improving the sewage system, a general view remained pervasive that filth and disease ran hand in hand. And so the predominant theory was still that polio transmission would be reduced only through attention to personal cleanliness and general hygiene and a reduction in filth of all kinds in the environment. Many untested theories related to poorer areas took hold, including that polio was carried by flies, leading to a huge Swat the Fly campaign and a focus on placing screens around babies to keep flies from landing on them and transmitting the disease. Cats and other domestic animals also became suspect. On July 26th, the New York Times reported that 80,000 cats and dogs, although mostly cats, had been slaughtered that summer because of fear of polio transmission. Milk and dust were both considered as potential vectors, and the milk supplies were scrutinized, with both pasteurized and unpasteurized milk coming under attack. The idea that objects could be carriers for the disease also remained a concern. In New Jersey, people traveling from New York were barred from entry if carrying rags or paper, and children were restricted from traveling at all. In New York City, library books were burned if returned from a home where infection was known. Children with polio could be forcibly removed to hospitals as part of the campaign to reduce transmission of the disease. Some families resisted having their children taken and even actively concealed them from health workers. The wealthy fled to the countryside, hoping to avoid exposure. By the time it was over, the 1916 epidemic had killed a total of 6,000 people in the U.S., with more than 2,000 in New York alone, and the virus had paralyzed 27,000 across the country. Polio had arrived with a vengeance and was here to stay. In the aftermath of the outbreak, public health officials remained baffled. around 80% of the cases were children under the age of 5. But children in rural counties who got the disease tended to be older and were also more likely to die. Poor immigrants were stricken, but so too were middle-class children. Boys were more commonly affected than girls, and black children were seemingly less likely to get sick than whites. Staten Island was a particular mystery. The incidence there was the highest in the 5 boroughs, yet the population density was much lower and the poverty rate was also low. Most of the families on Staten Island were not immigrants and lived in houses with a high standard of sanitation, often including indoor toilets. Wade Frost, an epidemiologist for the federal government, had in 1911 made the same observation. Those in rural areas were more susceptible and tended to contract polio at an older age than those in cities. Nonetheless, the perception remained ingrained that cleanliness and staying away from urban environments would help keep polio at bay. Although many theories of transmission swirled across New York City during the 1916 outbreak, researchers in Sweden had already correctly identified the mechanism in 1912. The team, led by Carl Kling at the State Bacteriological Institute, had demonstrated that they could isolate the polio virus in the human intestinal tract. This finding suggested the route of transmission, through the mouth and the gut, then into the bloodstream, where it would travel to the nerves of the spinal cord and brain. These Swedish researchers presented their findings at an international conference in Washington, D.C., but for unknown reasons, their theory received an indifferent response, and it would be decades before its truth was recognized. Many polio researchers and doctors believed instead that polio entered the body through the nose and then traveled directly to the nerves in the brain. This nasal theory was championed by Simon Flexner, the extremely powerful director of the Rockefeller Institute in New York City. Founded in 1901, the Rockefeller Institute was a hotbed for polio research. Studying polio was hard because it did not naturally infect animals. At the time, only monkeys were known to be susceptible, so research on polio required access to these animals, which were expensive and difficult to handle. But the Rockefeller Institute was rich, and Flexner procured monkeys. Flexner then made a devastatingly costly error. He chose to use a specific monkey, the Macaca mulata, rhesus monkey. While other monkeys are susceptible to polio, the rhesus monkey is more resistant to infection, particularly via the oral route, and can only become infected reliably by injecting the virus directly into the brain or spinal cord. Flexner did experiments on his rhesus monkeys, sticking swabs with the polio virus all the way up their noses. The monkeys got sick, and he could isolate the virus in the olfactory nerves as well as in parts of the brain. In a report in 1910, Flexner, with his colleague Paul Lewis, commented authoritatively, "The experimental results show that a path of elimination of the virus of poliomyelitis is by way of the nasopharyngeal mucosa, and indicate that the same path may be traversed in the course of infection." Nobody thought to question whether assessment in humans, or even a different species of monkey, might yield other results. Because Flexner and his colleagues were so persuasive, this misunderstanding regarding the route of transmission lasted for decades. Lots of effort went into finding a way to protect people by blocking up their noses so the virus could not enter. One trial in Toronto in 1937 used a zinc sulfate nasal spray as prophylaxis, to no avail. By the early 1940s, Flexner's nasal theory had been overturned. A study in 1938 showed that the polio virus could be detected in the stool of patients, which would be unlikely had the virus been transmitted via the nasal route. Work by Albert Sabin, a researcher at the University of Cincinnati, and others in the 1940s showed that other types of monkeys could become infected with polio if fed the virus, and also that the virus could almost never be isolated in the olfactory bulb, the nose, of infected individuals. It was definitive. The virus was transmitted primarily by the fecal-oral.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?